Hello, welcome to episode zero of Back in My Play. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and the other panelists this week are, first off, Josh Hiller. Am I saying your last? I should have asked what your last name, how it was pronounced, Josh.
Hillier.
Hillier. Yeah, that makes sense.
But I get Hiller a lot, which is cool.
All right, well, thank you for being
dude.
Awesome. And also, we have Trey Gibson, who is going to be probably our super, super diehard Skype icon, is the Triforce mega fan of Zelda, although Josh and I are obviously huge fans as well. Trey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm great. It is the day before E3. We're here to talk about old games because all that new stuff is coming out tomorrow. But to, again, kind of set the stage for people out there, this is obviously episode zero. It's a brand new podcast. It's called Back in My Play because, you know, again, I've been going back and forth to these guys as well. I'm a very nostalgic person. I like to remember my past and or, you know, things back in the day where, you know, things were just so different. Things have changed quite a bit in the last 25 years or so. And today we're going to be talking about something that is very near and dear to our hearts and something that we're all nostalgic about. And that is The Legend of Zelda for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it is something that we all grew up loving quite a bit. It is, doesn't even need to be said, it's a classic. So just to, again, set the stage for you, we're back in the United States in 1987, for us at least. In Japan, the game came out in February of 1986 on the Famicom Disk System, which, you know, by the way, there is also a cart version of The Legend of Zelda, but the Famicom Disk System, if you don't know what it is, kind of, you know, look it up. It was a floppy disk system that Nintendo came out with when there was chip shortages and all this stuff, but we're not going to get into that. It's not what we're here to talk about. But also, like I said, it came out in the United States about a year, or not about a year later, about 6 months later. And the big deal with The Legend of Zelda when it came out, two main things. A, it looked sick because it was a gold-painted cartridge, and B, no passwords. You could, like, actually back the game up on the card itself with its built-in battery save. So, super revolutionary back then. And also,
yeah.
Just talking about kind of the rest of the landscape for the Nintendo at the time, the NES. This is when we had games like Metroid coming out in 87. We had the very first Mega Man, Kid Icarus, Castlevania. This is where those heavy hitters, these are franchises that have stuck with us for the last 25 years. They all started coming out, at least in the United States, on the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it was really a time for innovation. And again, to step back a little bit, we are all about 26, 27, 28 years old. So we were about one or two or three when this game came out. But we obviously played it eventually. But, you know, first thing I want to talk to you guys about before we get into the rest of the stuff. Actually, you know, quickly I will mention, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto, known as the producer and the creator of the game. He went out in the woods, and you've heard all this story. We're not going to talk about the history of the game. If you want to find that, you can pick up some great resources like Hyrule Historia. And also, GameSpy Journal 14 is The Anatomy of Zelda Volume 1, which is also really good that you can check out to get the history. But I just wanted to quickly mention Shigeru Miyamoto and the composer, Koji Kondo, who went on to score the rest of the Zelda series, except for, I believe, Zelda 2. He did not score for some reason. But the I don't know if I'm incorrect about that, but that's what I got from Wikipedia. If you guys want to correct me on that, feel free to do so right now.
No, it sounds right.
Okay. And again, let's kind of step back to some of the memories that we have, because again, we're going to be doing something that's a little bit different. Obviously, there's other podcasts out there that do the retro game thing. They talk about series, and they talk about consoles. They talk about the specific history about that. But I want to make this a personal show where we talk about our history of the game. So that's where we're going to start today, now that we got all that out of the way. So again, it's late 80s, early 90s. The three of us are just being able to read maybe a little bit, probably not. But we had an NES in the house. We had a gold cartridge that said The Legend of Zelda. We popped that in and the music started up and we just hit start. And then we just get plopped into the world. So, Trey, you have a kind of a unique history with the series, so I want to throw it to you first. What are your earliest memories of The Legend of Zelda in a whole? Like, what are your earliest memories of the game?
Well, I remember being probably 4 years old. My dad had the game, and he would play it a lot, and I would have the second controller, and I would always think I was playing. We did that. That was more the case with Mario, but Legend of Zelda was the first game I ever played, and I remember being able to get the sword and beat the first dungeon, and that's where everything else goes fuzzy. I remember had that first dungeon down like science, and for being a 4 year old kid, being able to do that, I thought that was pretty impressive. But you know, whenever I think back to, you know, being a toddler and being, you know, that age, Nintendo and Legend of Zelda come to mind just because that was what I would always play. My dad got the second one, and I would not play it. I would only go back to the first one because it was so much different. But, yeah, I could probably get that sword and beat the first level over and over and over. That was my thing when I was a little kid. So
I have to ask, were you somehow put off by, like, the aesthetics of Zelda 2, or is it just something where you were, like, something clicked with the first one where you just kept going back to it?
I had an attachment to it. Just because it was the first game I'd ever played. It was the first time I was able to do something on my own, because my dad would do stuff like in the games and I would watch and I would kind of get an idea of what he was doing. And I would remember that, but it wasn't anything like, you know, I just felt more of an attachment. Zelda 2 is a very difficult, but a unique game in its own aspect. But, you know, fundamentally it's a lot different than the very first one. And I just think, you know, those fundamental differences along with the personal attachment I had to the game, you know, is what set it apart for me.
Josh, how about you? Earliest memories of The Legend of Zelda? Josh, you there? I think Josh muted himself or potentially is on the phone. So I'm going to jump in instead. So again, the reason why I wanted to start off with The Legend of Zelda, it is probably the game I have the fondest memories of, because again, I started out with an Atari 2600 and we eventually got an NES probably in 89, or asking my parents, they all say 89. So I'm guessing it was about that time period. And I never owned The Legend of Zelda when I was a kid. It was something that I rented over and over and over again from our local video store. And every time we went in there, I would just keep renting this game. I, you know, sometimes I'd veer off and I'd maybe pick up something like, I know something that for some reason I ended up renting a lot was Mega Man 2. And I don't know why. I don't know if my brother rented it because we had Nintendo Power back in the day and it was showing up in there and it looked cool. But for some reason we picked that up too. But it was really just going back and renting it multiple times and not really knowing what to do, just kind of going off and, much like you, Trey, going to that first dungeon and beating it and then not knowing what the hell to do or not having the attention span to go much further, because being 3 or 4 years old, it's, you know, a pretty advanced game for someone that age. Mm-hmm. The other aspect is my cousin Ben, who's 8 years older than me, he also had the game and he more or less mastered the game. He was, as I became like, you know, 5 and 6 years old, I would continue to rent this game, you know, on and off, and I would call his ass on the phone so much to the point where my aunt had to call my parents and say, Kevin needs to stop calling Ben. He cannot talk to him about Zelda all day, because I was always like, man, you got to walk me, where are the heart containers? Like, he knew where all the heart containers were. He knew where all the secrets were. He knew where all the dungeons were. So I was constantly like calling him up to try to get some information, because That's pretty much all you could do is you would either talk to a friend or a family member that has the information, and they either got it from discovering or they got it from another party. We obviously had things like Nintendo Power, and eventually, thanks to the local library doing a book sale. Again, I can't believe I can remember this, but when I was about five, at the local library, they had a book sale, and there we picked up the official Nintendo Player's Guide, which had maps for up to Dungeon 5 or 6, and it had a bunch of where the secret areas and stuff like that. And I just remember kind of going back and almost trying to brute force it over and over and over again. But at that time period, I just could never really get towards the end because, again, being 5 or 6 and you can't read, you can't do anything with hints, and you can't remember stuff as well. So it never really got to the point where I was able to complete the game.
Yeah, you know, for me, when I kill the boss of the first dungeon, that was like a milestone for me. So, like, in my own little world, I think his name was Aquamentus, I think was the name of the first boss. When I beat him at 3 or 4 years old, I'm like, oh man, you know,
that could be the whole game.
Yeah, there was no Ganon in my mind. I was like, oh, I beat the dragon. Oh, I won. Yes.
Done deal.
And my dad would be like, no, you got, you know, 8 more levels to go. What?
That's super interesting that you had a parent that was actually playing the games. Like, my parents never got into them. They never really. They never really supported them. For some reason, we had the things, but we would only get... The reason why I had to keep renting Zelda is we got, like, 1 or 2 games a year. Mm-hmm. So I was either stuck playing, like, some... Oh, man, we had some shitty games back in the day, but we'd end up getting a terrible game for Christmas, and then I would just have to go and just pray, man, I hope my parents are going to the video store this weekend so I can rent a game. Please, 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 please. Josh, are you back?
I think he disconnected from the call. You want to try to re-add him?
That's weird. I still got him. Oh, maybe it's... Oh, you're right. He is disconnected from the call. So let's take a quick break. We're going to be right back, and we'll have Josh on the line. Pause for a second. Okay, it looks like Josh is having some internet difficulties, so we're not going to be able to talk to him just yet, but we'll end up talking to him in a little bit. I think he's having trouble getting back on Skype. So... let's continue just to talk about some of the early days. I wrote down a couple notes, and really the coolest thing about the cartridge is that it had that save game possibility. But there was one time when I actually got like pretty deep, like maybe the 6th or the 7th dungeon, and then turned off my game, went to go do something else, go play outside, jump in the pool or something like that. Come back, turn the system on. There's no game saves there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like a common problem. Like, this was something that I guess Nintendo ended up addressing down the road to the point where it was in Nintendo Power, the tip, in case it was like in the tips and tricks or something like that, where in case your Zelda save was disappearing, that you have to hold down the reset button for 3 seconds and then power off your system. Did that ever happen to you?
I never knew about that tip. I didn't really get into Nintendo Power until later on. I didn't hear about that tip, but I lost many save files with Legend of Zelda. You know, as I got older, I kind of started to understand how the specifics of that worked a little bit, but, you know, at the time, when I lose a save file, being, you know, farther in the game as I got older, I would get farther. I would get really mad because, hey, I've been playing for the last 6 hours. Why is my game save gone? I didn't understand. I just knew Nintendo cheated me. So, you know.
Well, that's a risk that you run with that new technology, that new risky, you know, Nintendo's always driving innovation. Yep. And they, I guess, you know, all joking aside, they really were back then. And that is why we ran into some issues. So I got word Josh is back on Skype. He has got that stuff figured out. So we're going to add him right now. Okay, Josh is back. So again, that same question kind of posed to you, Josh. What are some of your earliest memories of The Legend of Zelda, or some of the things that you're most nostalgic for?
Yeah, so I got The Legend of Zelda. First of all, there's this weird phenomenon when you're a kid of you just kind of receive things that your parents buy you. You know, when you're very young, you receive things that you didn't ask for, and sometimes you're really excited about them. And so I received an NES for Christmas when I was 5 years old. Yeah, so that would be 1989. So what was that? 3 or 4 years after it came out in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I received it as a 5 year old with Super Mario Brothers, Duck Hunt, and Legend of Zelda. Which, you know, aside from Duck Hunt, talk about a nice lineup of games.
Yeah.
And even Duck Hunt for some sort of nostalgic reasons, I suppose. But anyway, I played Legend of Zelda. So I was learning what video games were while I was playing Legend of Zelda. So just think about that for a minute in terms of a strange way to play the game.
Yeah.
Nintendo, your first experience with video games ever? NES? Okay, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, aside from maybe I'd played an arcade game or something before that, but I don't even know if I had, because, you know, five is pretty young. So I played Super Mario Brothers first because it seemed like the most accessible game, even as a five-year-old, and messed around with Duck Hunt. And then I started playing Zelda, and I played it basically like an arcade game. I just sort of like walking around a map, seeing how many enemies I could slay. I understood that I needed to go get the sword right away, you know, that I needed to walk north into the west a little bit to that cave and grab the sword. But after that, 5-year-old Josh took over and he just started walking around, sort of enjoying the like playground elements of the game, you know, kind of stumbling into things and just fighting enemies. So I think that as a 5 or 6 year old, I probably only completed one dungeon. And I distinctly remember, okay, this is weird. I distinctly remember unlocking Dungeon 8, like, in my or second playthrough. Yeah, so you know, you can throw the fire a little bit.
Yeah.
And burn that bush. And,
yeah, that bush sticks out, man. That's, like, that's basically just saying, burn this.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, even to a 5-year-old, right? It's like, you better burn this. So maybe that started some bad habits for me. but anyway, I burned that and walked into Dungeon 8. And I want to say that might have been the first dungeon I played in the game.
Oh, wow.
Which is a very bad dungeon to start with.
Yeah.
You can agree with me on that one.
Sure.
Go on.
I was just going to say, you brought up two really good points. One, that, you know, in the mindset of a 4 or 5-year-old, you're looking at The Legend of Zelda almost as jumping into it, not knowing anything, and just the amazing job that they did designing that world, where you knew right off the bat, all right, they basically, like, the one thing, not to get off track, Link's Awakening, I was playing it recently, and I was remembering back in the day, it took me like an hour to find the goddamn sword at the start of that game, and that kind of bugged me quite a bit. But in the start of Legend of Zelda, it's the very first possible place you could go. That's where you pick up the sword, and then you're off. The adventure gets going, and even
it's visible on that first screen, right? I'm pretty sure you can see that cave. That's the first things you see.
Yeah. So it's in terms of like kind of almost funneling you towards where they want you to go. They're basically just doing that, doing a great job of that off the bat, getting you to get the sword. And to bring something up that they brought up in The Anatomy of Zelda, the GameSpy journal that came out, how they always kind of push you up. Like, you're always thinking progression was always up a screen, up a screen, up a screen. And if you think about it, they do that through all the dungeons. They do that through much of the world map. Really, the higher you go up, you know, you're going to risk more danger, aside from going west, where you're obviously going to have to deal with some of the more powerful enemies out to the west, especially. But you know, I just wanted to make that note. It's a really interesting thing that you brought up.
Yeah, well, and I think that the observation of, like, north, you know, like, everything is leading you north, and they even start you, like, literally at the bottom of the map, like, right by the beach, you know? Which is very similar to each dungeon. There's never an entrance to a dungeon, at least not that I can think of, where you start like in the center, you know?
Yeah, they all have the same screen. You're starting at the very bottom.
Yeah, and they have the statues.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So now, you know, again, talking about, you know, those early memories, there's obviously that main quest, and eventually throughout the last 20 years or so, I've gone back to the game multiple times, and I've, in bits and spurts, like, I literally have played that thing on everything that's been available on. I bought the Game Boy Advance copy. I had that Zelda collector's disc. I bought it on Virtual Console on the Wii. I've repurchased this game over and over again, even though I have a gold cartridge, which isn't the original one that I had, but obviously I went back and bought NES games and stuff like that once I had some money. So I never got to the end of the game. I was always going and going and going, then getting distracted or something like that. But Trey, I know you kind of eventually, you obviously got through the game, and then you went into the second quest. Like, that was something that was, again, revolutionary for the game, where they basically used the same map and gave you, or the same overworld, they gave you DLC in the form of a whole second quest, and said, all right, guess what? Twice as hard, maybe even more than that. Go for it. Not everything is in the same place. Everything's pretty much spread out differently. And you actually played through that.
Yes, it was really difficult.
So what are the main difference? What did you have to go through?
Okay, well, I'll start off with I took a couple notes about this just because, you know, I'm 27 now. I think I beat the second quest when I was maybe 21 or 22. I was having a little Zelda marathon, basically, and I didn't play through the, like, when I started doing that, I didn't play through the game the first time. I just made a file. You can make you can name your character Zelda, and it'll automatically start you on the second quest. Otherwise, you have to beat the first quest, and then it'll give you the option to start the second quest. But when I was playing through it, I can't remember everything about it. But the second quest actually started. It was the game's developer. He only used half of the available memory for the dungeons and whatnot. So he decided, instead of just redoing the game, which was an option, he decided to basically create 9 more maps and create the second quest. So it was actually, second quest was actually implemented because of a mistake, because he didn't use all the memory of the level design. So I thought that was kind of a little neat fact.
So are the dungeons laid out differently too?
What's that?
So are the dungeons, I know they're in different areas, but are the layouts of the dungeons different too?
Yes, they're completely different. A lot of the levels have mini bosses in them now. You'll fight, you know, various, like, you'll fight Dodongos a couple times, you'll fight...
We can always call them spider dudes, those are the obviously, the dinosaur-looking dudes, but I know people might want us to use the technical names, but I'm thinking, back in the day, I just called it, man, that huge-ass spider. I didn't say ass, but I was like, that huge spider, or those snake-looking fire things.
Yeah, I thought the Dodongos looked like Triceratops, so that's what I
thought. Yeah, yeah.
Without the horn.
Exactly.
That was sort of playground talk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, did you get to that Triceratops? You see those 3 of those in the 7th stage?
You gotta use the bombs. You gotta use the, if you use the bombs, you'll kill them.
No, but I can't get it. Oh, no, you gotta put it in front of its mouth, all that stuff. That was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, oh man, gosh. So many memories of that. The dungeons are completely laid out differently. The way you go about acquiring items is different. The main thing about the second quest is, you know, I consider the first quest, there's not hand-holding in that at all. They pretty much turn you loose, you get the sword, and then, you know, you're on your own. Second quest is even, you know, more difficult than that. A lot of the dungeons, to progress, you have to bomb certain walls, and that's how you get to new rooms. There's so many times you'll come to a dead end, and you're like, well, what do I do? And you'll bomb a room, you go in that room, then you have to bomb the other side of the room to get further in the dungeon. And there's no, they don't give you any kind of hints. So it's difficult, you know, one, to find out where you're going, and two, the enemies, you know, like the Dark Nuts, you know, the knight-looking guys, playground talk, the knights with the shields. The blue ones.
Blue Knights,
they're in the first dungeon.
Oh, man, those guys, honestly, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I never want to see a Blue Knight or what I would call, a Blue Ghost. I don't want to see those ever again, even though I know they're called Dark Nuts and Wizorbs.
Yeah, in the second quest, you encountered those way earlier than you did in the first quest.
So you're basically I just finished the game today, so I see it's giving me that second quest save available now, and you literally restart with three. Even after you finish the game, you have to go back into it with only three heart containers, and you got nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, you're starting completely over. No advantage. In fact, you're at a disadvantage because of how hard it is. I mean, you know, a lot of people consider the first quest to be pretty difficult. I mean, it's got some frustrating parts, but the second quest from start to end is very, very difficult. It's beatable. I wouldn't put it, I'd maybe put it in like the top 10 hardest things I've done in games. But
So are the hearts and like money and different things you can find on the map, like are they still in the same places in the second quest?
I want to say they are. That was one of the things I was trying to look up. I think the heart containers might be in the same spot. I think the main thing that got redesigned is I think the levels might be located in different spots, like the hidden ones, I think. And I know the maps in the levels are completely redesigned.
Okay, so each dungeon is remapped.
Yeah, yeah. You still start at the bottom and everything, but like the map is different, like how you access different rooms and, you know what you acquire. I started playing through the first one. I think you get the two boomerangs. I think you get both of them in the first level. You get the basic boomerang, and then you get the other one later on.
Is it any fun?
Yes.
Or is it like Dark Souls brutal?
No, not that brutal.
Okay. Because no. This is like the comparison that I got this replay through Zelda, because I completely replayed through it these past like 3 or 4 days, and the best comparison to what I have to like today is like Dark Souls and just getting my ass kicked, because I beat the game in 5 hours, but I died about 15 times. Mm-hmm. And those all came like, you know, in basically two dungeons, more or less. Like eighth dungeon was surprisingly easy, but the seventh dungeon was super hard. And obviously the ninth, where again, it's all what I'm going to call blue ghosts and blue knights. Those guys, even with the blue ring, you get...
They've got your number.
Oh, man. Sure do. Oh, it's just... It's like not even fair. Like, and I feel bad for my neighbors upstairs, because I was even like son of a bitch, because it's not even that, but you're also getting hit by the bubbles that basically don't allow you to use your sword, so you're getting juggled. You're basically getting bounced back and forth between the bubbles, and then, you know, maybe there's not like the blob things, but those guys that swallow your shield that will also, they can swallow your shield, so you're getting bounced into those guys, and then there's dark nuts, and there's the ghost. It's totally brutal. I cannot even imagine what it must be like in that second quest.
Yeah, I think the difficulty of the enemies is about the same, like as far as like killing them and whatnot, but just you encounter them earlier with less equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So you're having to kill them. So it's kind of like an illusion of extra difficulty, because you're fighting them earlier than you would have in the first playthrough. So you don't have the blue sword or the white sword when you're killing them. You don't have the magic sword when you're fighting the blue knights. You know, you're lower on equipment. So it is, it's just you fight them. And if you haven't played through the first playthrough and seen them, then you're just going to pull your hair out. But it's
I don't think it would be impossible to play the second playthrough first, right? I mean, I know you can enter Zelda as your name and just start playing, but
for fun, you do it because you heard about it, and then you go in and you're like, actually, no, thank you.
I've
never met somebody that's never played the first playthrough but beaten the second playthrough, and if I did, I would shake their hand and proclaim them like Master of Zelda. But you know, it's just I don't know. That's I haven't met anybody that's done that. I've only beaten the second quest one time. I just worked up the patience and did it. So it was very rewarding. It was, difficult enough to where when I got done, I'm like, I really accomplished something today. So, but it's a challenge. If you're looking for something that will really test you, retro.
Did you guys ever had any like kind of, back in the day, did you have any events where you, again, whether it's like on the playground or you saw it in Nintendo Power, where you're like, I didn't know about the blue ring. Like, I didn't know there was a store up there. And when I found out about the blue ring as a kid, it was the most magical thing ever because I had maxed out rubies because I was just going all over the world and I was had maxed out money. And just finding that was a complete revelation that, oh, wait, half damage? Are you serious? This is going to make the game super easy.
Right. It's been there all along.
Yeah. And it was just like the ability to discover that stuff and how it is virtually impossible, even in today's Zelda games, whether it be like Twilight Princess or Skyward Sword, we're just never going to be able to experience stuff like that today. Was there anything like that in the game back then, or where you had, you know, or whether it be like you said, stumbling over the eighth dungeon, or maybe, you know, searching and searching and searching for something and then finally finding it or having someone help you reach that point? Did you guys have any experiences like that?
I figured out the Lost Woods sequence on my own, even though really you just go.
Oh, for real?
Times. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's...
That was a phone call to Cousin Ben for me.
Yeah, when you think about it now, it's kind of simple going up five times, but I mean, like, I figured, like, I accidentally stumbled upon it, and I was like, whoa, what's this? And I went in there, and it was level five. I'm like, whoa.
No way.
You
know,
like,
I thought the Lost Woods was the one in the, like, southwestern part of the map.
Oh, yeah, the up, over, down, over. That's how he described it to me. Up, over, down, over. And it's still, I swear to God, to this day, I remember it.
I'm thinking of the mountains.
Yeah, I think you're thinking of the mountains. But no, I mean, that's still a secret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a secret to everyone.
It makes the secret discovery noise, so.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, that was that discussion about the Lost Woods. The, what is it again? What is the sequence again?
For the up, left, down, left.
Yeah, like that was something that I was told about literally on a playground.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
nice.
So, you know, when I said playground talk, that was, you know, because that's sort of the water cooler for kids, you know, like the office water cooler.
Yeah, then you got to sit in school the rest of the day and you're like, oh man, I got to get home, play Zelda, got to get home, play Zelda, get home, play Zelda, now I can keep moving forward.
Yes, exactly. And you have to hope that your friends didn't lie to you.
Yeah.
The wrong sequence, you know, because that's the way my friends were, that they would make something like that up. But actually, this ended up being good information I received, and I was super pumped up about it. Yeah.
So did you guys have, we won't get deep into this, but did you have access to things like Nintendo Power? Like I was mentioning before, at the local library during a book sale, I was able to pick up the famous black official Nintendo Player's Guide, which basically covered, you know, dozens of NES games. Did you guys have access? I know, Trey, you said you weren't in, didn't have a Nintendo Power subscription in the beginning. Josh, did you?
I did, yeah. And this is another thing I didn't ask for. It's like my parents were just trying to set me up to be this Nintendo guy.
Your parents loved you, man.
You know? They must have. They must have.
You can tell by how much they buy you.
Yeah, that's how you show love, right?
I think so.
But anyway, I don't know, maybe it was the fact that you got a free video game with a subscription back then. You know, that was sort of a big thing.
That Dragon Warrior coming in pretty soon, man.
Yeah,
it's coming in the mail.
Still waiting with bated breath. yeah, I had the subscription. But you know what? I don't remember really reading about Zelda strategies. So maybe I got the subscription after they had published most of that.
Well,
sort of like with the run-up to Link to the Past.
Well, the problem is that the you know, first issue of Nintendo Power was 88. So it came out, but there were still, I remember being some strategies. I don't know if it was in the first issue or the second issue, but it was definitely before the fourth issue was Zelda 2. But there were still, like, even in those, like, first four issues, there was always, like, in Tips and Tricks, there would be strategies for the original Legend of Zelda still. And
that makes sense, you know, because it was a deeper game than a lot of the games on the system at the time.
Well, yeah, and people were still discovering the NES, or they, you know, may have just been discovering the Legend of Zelda because, again, people weren't connected back in the day. The most connected you might be is like that Sears catalog or like walking into Toys R Us to know what's out. So you're more or less stuck with either having, you know, a friend tell you about it, or eventually we got to see games in Nintendo Power and be like, I need that, or it's like at the top of that Nintendo Power most wanted list. So obviously that's something I have to pick up.
I do miss that, though. Sort of, as much as I love indie games and digital distribution and how widespread things are, and, you know, there are like thousands of games being released every year when you factor in all the indie games, it was kind of nice having like everybody playing some of the same things at the same time and discovering things at the same time.
Yeah, like going over and finding out, yeah, man, I like watching DuckTales. Oh, you got DuckTales? Yeah, let's see what it's like. Oh, crap.
Right.
Oh, I had a friend that had that, and I'd go stay at his house on the weekend just to play that game.
But that's the thing. We're going to talk about it in a little bit, but kids these days are not going to be able to really experience that where they could, you know, go over and be like, oh, man, you got all these games that I don't have because, like I said, I got two games. Like me and my brother might get a game a piece of Christmas and maybe a game for our birthday. So maximum 4 games a year, and half of those are going to be like garbage, like To the Earth or something like that for the Zapper. or I'm gonna have something that's just gonna be like potentially a classic, but mostly it's gonna be stuff that's gonna be worthless. And I might play once, but we usually got lucky and got Mike Tyson's Punch Out or something else like that.
I only had 6 or 7 NES games until I got the Super Nintendo. I eventually went to a flea market and bought a couple older ones when I got a little bit older and wanted to go back and play them. I had like Super Mario, Zelda, then Adventure of Link, Mike Tyson's Punch Out, Ninja Turtles arcade game.
Oh, you got to see. I had like the first Ninja Turtles, which basically everyone I knew had. Like everyone seemed to pick
that
up.
Swimming sequence.
No,
that's as far as I got.
Same here. Never got past that.
Yeah, I never beat that level, so I don't know how that game ends. I've never gone back and played it either. You know, I didn't have a lot of games either, so it was cool to be able to go and hang out at a buddy's house and bring Zelda with me and be like, dude, look at this. You know, you're used to playing Mario. You're used to playing Castlevania, Mega Man. You, like, go from side to side.
Yeah, drop that baby stuff and play some Legend of Zelda. It's way better.
Check this game out. They're going to start you in here. You're going to walk up and get this sword. And, by the way, in 20 years, that phrase that he says to you will be iconic. And then they turn you loose, and you go wherever you want to go. You can go up, you can go down, left, right.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't, like, write over your game save, you'd be like, oh, man, you asshole.
You know, that didn't happen, surprisingly, when I was a kid. That didn't happen. But I've got a buddy.
He's lucky.
And he'll probably listen to this, so I'm going to call him out. He's deleted several of my game files. So I won't call him any names, but he knows who he is. But, yeah, that didn't really
intentionally
happen.
Intentionally or...
What a dirtbag.
Accidentally, you know, I'll get into the story a little bit later on, but you know, it's he erased one of my games. I wasn't paying attention, and he tried to go back through and catch me up to where I was. I was on the
computer. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give him credit. I wasn't mad at him after I found out what he did, but I think I was playing Diablo 2 at the time. I was just totally involved in that game, and he deleted my game save on one of my other games. And while I was playing Diablo 2, he was over there like huddled by the TV trying to catch me up to where I last was. And by the time I realized that, he was almost back to where I was.
Before we go into the next segment, we're coming up in about 40 minutes for the first segment. A little bit long, but any final thoughts, Josh, on early memories of The Legend of Zelda specifically?
Yeah, I think that we look to it now as sort of I'm getting into legacy a little bit, I know, but just that feeling of a sandbox, you know, it just really nailed that for me. And this, like, the sense of play. And I understand that Shigeru Miyamoto, when he was originally talking about that game, or in subsequent years, he's talked about how he was trying to basically capture the experience of being a kid and adventuring out into the woods. You know, I really picked up on that, like, right away as a 5-year-old, even though I wasn't picking up on a lot of the things I was supposed to understand. I got the idea of you can go anywhere, you know, and yeah, you can stumble into Dungeon 8 if you want to. You won't make it through with just 3 hearts and, you know, the very first sword you get. But the fact that you could do that was just so cool in a world of Mario Brothers and Castlevania and Duck Hunt and games like that. So I just think it was a really important game, you know, and like, I was really lucky that was one of the first games I played, even though I didn't understand it really until I was like 10 years old.
It would be interesting, or I guess it would be interesting to consider, you know, what kind of impact that first game or two that you pick up has on you for the rest of your, you know, video game playing lives, or even how it shapes how you like video games in the future, because you can get that mind molded in such a way at that young age, but Trey, it obviously affected you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a 3-4 year old kid, And, you know, obviously the hero's name is Link, but when it told me to enter my name, you know, like I let my imagination run. And, it, you know, it's like Josh said, that he's trying to capture the feeling of being a child. And I named my guy Trey. And here I am playing this character, exploring and looking and doing things on my terms. It, you know, it had an effect on me. I mean, I really owe a lot to that game for how, you know, why I like playing games now. It's what, you know, it captured my imagination and let me kind of, you know, fall into this world, even though I didn't truly understand it at that age. But now as I've gotten older, I understand what they were going for and I can respect that. And I can see, you know, what their intentions were. So I'm thankful now. I have a feeling of gratitude for that game being around as long as it was and doing what it did. But, you know, as a kid when I played it, I think my imagination kind of took over. And, you know, that's part of the reason I enjoyed it so much then. So
a word that you kept saying in your summary of the game was imagination, and that you were able to let your imagination run wild. And that just really is sort of a testament to it not doing too much handholding, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That you were able to make that experience what it, like that it's been what you needed to be, what you needed it to be as a 3-year-old and as a 5-year-old and as a 20-year-old, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That you could just let your imagination run wild at whatever stage you are in life.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, like, you know, the game had set enemies, it had set lands and everything, but when you're, you know, a 3-4-year-old kid, like you're taking over this character and you're just kind of like, oh man, I'm going to go fight the big boss at the end. I'm about to kill a dragon. And, you know, I'm just envisioning myself fighting this dragon. Then I get there and kill it. I'm just like, man, that was awesome. So
yeah.
it played a, you know, had a big impact on me as a kid. It was, you know, something I kind of cherish to this day, to get a little sentimental, but you know, it's just one of those things. So yeah, good talk.
Yeah, you know, I just throw final thoughts out there. It's again, when we started putting this together, I talked to both Josh and Trey separately on you know, the phone to kind of get a feeling for everyone. And I think one of the things that I brought up to both of them is that for some reason, The Legend of Zelda is probably my favorite game franchise of all time, and it kind of. I've never finished The Legend of Zelda. I've never finished, obviously, Zelda 2. I finished Link to the Past and a couple of the future games, but this one I never finished. But anyways, the series always kind of hit onto a specific note with me and in games in general, because the household life was not always the best where when I was very young, and eventually led to a divorce. So the video games were always kind of a way to go into the game room or the kids' room, play a game and not really think about the rest of the stuff that's going on. And it just happened that as I got older, we mentioned Link to the Past later on in the show because we kind of recorded things out of order, but when Link to the Past came out right as my parents got divorced, and they picked that up for me for Christmas, and it basically was like my escape. And that's kind of always how I've looked at these games, specifically The Legend of Zelda. And I guess you can kind of look at how it's been adapted to other franchises, that idea of a complete adventure where you go off, you have to do these tasks to affect the world. And that's something that I've always been able to really sink my teeth in. And I'm not great with my imagination. I'm not a super creative person. So having that world to go into was fantastic. And it's something that has just, again, always really stuck with me over these years. And I think that's why I kind of look back at the franchise and Nintendo to a certain respect so nostalgically, just because, again, it's that familiarity of that almost that safe place where you could go in and be a powerful dude with a sword and a shield and all these powers and all these items, and you were able to do all these things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And that's what something that I think a lot of people who don't play video games understand about why people play video games. Because it gives you that possibility to do something that is so different, and it's not passive like watching a movie, and it's not wasting your time. It's just like the same kind of experience people get to do with reading a book, but it's your specific actions and not necessarily someone who has just made a rigid story. So it allowed me to kind of do a little bit of both.
Well, and that's really interesting, you know, talking about the idea of agency, you know, and that you get to do a lot more when you're playing a video game, and that you were picking up on that as a kid, even though it might have been subconsciously.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like that was a situation with the divorce and everything, where you lost a lot of agency, just like, you know, like kids do in those situations. You know, it's the parents who make that decision. And that was like a separate world you could go to, you know, and I completely agree. I've had games that have been like that at different times of my life.
Yeah, the games become almost the games like almost become top priority. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh my god, I have to play this game. I'm not going to care about anything else. Oh wait, I haven't even eaten since breakfast. It's now like 6 p.m. Oh mm-hmm. crap! Like it's because you're able to kind of restructure your priorities and the things that you worry about, and obviously the thing that we hope today as adults is that we make sure we don't structure or we arrange those priorities incorrectly now that we actually have full things like lives to do and stuff like that. But for that time period, it was something that I could allow to take over my life, and I could just kind of like, you know, sit in front of that tube TV and, you know, listen to that music all day.
Yeah, yeah. And that stuff never changed, you know?
No. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. You get to listen to some awesome music from The Legend of Zelda. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about what it was like revisiting the game almost, 25 years later, 26 years later. So stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, for the third segment, or I guess really the second segment, we're going to be going back into The Legend of Zelda with today's eyes. So the last couple days, we have gone back and played the game again to kind of get a new perspective and to see not only how the game holds up, but also really what stands out to us 26 years later. So the first thing I want to do is quickly go around the horn, and I want to ask both you guys, how did you go about playing this game? And I'll just quickly say 3DS with save states turned off, because that stuff is I do not believe in that. But Josh, how did you play the game?
Yeah, I did 3DS as well, and I used the save stater too, but I stopped after a while because it started to feel strange, kind of like what you were saying. And I was playing on the 3DS XL. And so there's sort of a weird thing with playing retro games on the 3DS, in that you can choose to either use the D-pad or the little slider, right? And it's not an analog slider. Some people incorrectly call it that sometimes, because you know it's not truly analogous to your movements like an analog stick would be. But it's I don't know. I find that to be somewhat more comfortable than the D-pad on the 3DS, which I'm a big D-pad guy always when playing retro games.
It clicks a lot, huh, that D-pad? Is that weird, like how it kind of, it almost slides a little bit too?
Yeah, it's a strange D-pad.
It is.
It's not bad. Like, I played through it on 3DS XL2 with the D-pad, and, you know, actually, while you were mentioning that, the game actually looks really good on the 3DS XL.
Yeah, and you don't have to hold select or do anything to make it look good either, like, you know, with some of the GBA games or original DS games. You know, it just looks nice.
How about you? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say though that that I was kind of, I don't know why, for some reason with that game, I guess it's the top-down perspective, I just kept going back and forth between the slider and the D-pad, trying to decide what felt right, and I almost wished I had played it on the NES after I did that.
How about you, Trey?
I hate to be similar, but I played it on 3DS XL as well.
So. Man, we're a bunch of 3DS fanboys.
Yeah, seriously.
That's okay.
Yeah, you know, it's just, and it's easy to play it there. You know, you can just, you don't have to take over the TV to do it.
Yep, I that, and I don't know, it's just easier when I was sitting in here by the crib, by the baby while she slept, I would play it and just kind of be on the, you know, having the ear out for when she cried. So it was just, it was convenient. So
that's the greatest thing you can possibly say about that. I hate buying games on the 3DS because we, again, well, in the future, we're going to be talking about not having a unified login or not being able to potentially buy a game like on your Wii U and then play that same game on your 3DS. If it's the same goddamn game, they charge you the same $5 wherever you go. So, but other than that, being able to open up 3DS, play for 20 minutes, close it, go do something else, come back a little, you know, come back later, play another 10 minutes, close it, go do something else, and it's always, you know, instant on made this a possibility to even do this podcast because I was traveling all weekend and I was really surprised at how much I enjoyed playing it on the 3DS XL. And that's after quickly on Thursday night thinking, all right, maybe I can blast through like the first six dungeons on the NES. So I fired up the NES, played through the first four dungeons, which is like talking through emails. We're talking about this too, but maybe it's like an hour of gameplay to get through the first like six dungeons, if you kind of know what you're going through, or at least the first like four dungeons. It's really just like almost muscle memory. You know what you're doing.
That's the truth.
But that was, you know, it's definitely a good way to play it. If you're thinking about playing this game again or going to it for the first time, 3DS is a great way to do it. And obviously it's not out on the Wii U yet, but you can get it through the Wii Shop channel on your Wii U or on the Wii, or pick up a Fantastic Gold Card for about $12 to $15 plus shipping on eBay right now.
And that's a cool thing to have, you know? So, I mean, that's something that I don't mind paying $15 for. I would pay more for that, actually. Just, well, you know, that gold card is so memorable.
Another pro tip is if you want to, like, I have a bunch of Famicom stuff, and I think Zelda, like on a Famicom, like the cart, obviously I don't know if you want to necessarily go and get the disc system version because magnetic discs aren't gonna last forever, so the cart itself runs about $10 for the Famicom too, if you want to get something that might be a little bit cheaper depending on where you live. But it is, carts are awesome. Plastic is great.
Yes, it is.
Plastic and silicone chips.
Yes, we can keep them around as long as possible. You know, I didn't think about it, but yeah, playing it on the Wii might be a good option for people as if they don't have a handheld because of all the control options you have. You know, you can hook up the classic controller, or you can play it like with the Wiimote on its side, sort of like the NES pad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, could you? I guess I can't remember. Can you play GameCube? Can you use the GameCube controller when playing Virtual Console games?
I don't think so.
Okay, you can't do that. No, actually, I don't know why you would want to.
I think you can, actually. Or maybe I'm thinking of the classic, the collector's edition.
Yeah.
But
that's probably,
I know some games support the GameCube controller and Virtual Console. I don't know if that's one of them.
And some people swear by that controller, you know?
It's. I like the WaveBird, but that's just because it's wireless. But I mean, that D-pad is atrocious.
It truly is, yeah.
So again, there's, Mentioning it before, there's literally a dozen iterations of how you can play this, whether it be on an NES or a Game Boy or a Game Boy Advance or a 3DS or whatever you want to play it on. But there's lots of great options to do it. And again, if you want to go 3DS, it plays great on there. It looks great and it sounds great. The emulation is perfect. Nintendo just allowed me to remap my button so I can stop talking about that every time I bring this up. So the experience going back in, I have to say, it was literally like riding a bike for those first five dungeons, immediately jumping in, going to the first dungeon, getting that first heart container, making sure I have a boomerang and I have the bow and arrow. And then since I had a couple bombs, I'm like, all right, I'm going to go get some money where I know where it is. I'm going to go get a bunch of heart containers. And then like the first five dungeons are super easy because you can be loaded up with heart containers once you buy the candle. And obviously you can, you know, if you know where the spots are, it's super quick to get basically halfway through the game. But I really started hitting a wall when it came to that seventh, eighth, ninth dungeon, and even like the sixth dungeon. Whenever those, when the dark nuts and the whiz robes start popping in, and I swear, I think there is just some magic programming that they did for those blue dark nuts where you are like trying to go after them and they just like pixel perfect turn and hit you and or make it so they get blocked. So I was somewhat surprised at how hard it was to kind of go back into the game. And personally, I think it was kind of hard to relearn those skills because I went so fast. Like I beat the game in 5 hours. And I think back in the day when we used to play the game and not really know where we're going, we got so so much practice in attacking these enemies where we got it down to a science. Yeah. And trying to kind of rush through the game for this show, I, you know, was getting manhandled. And I'm sure if I got lost in the dungeons a little bit more, I wasn't as familiar with them, maybe I would get more practice with them. I would be dying more. I'd be, again, going back in, getting more practice, learning their patterns. But I think that was one of the biggest things that stood out to me was still, this is a hard game. Like it's not easy by any stretch. And that's why I can't even imagine what that second quest must be like with the challenge that's in here. And also I'm going to toss it off to you guys, but the immersion in the game for a cart that came out in 87 with the sounds and the music,
yes,
and the level design and the layout of the land was just perfect. I forget who it was, but someone was mentioning, and this is something that I literally wrote down too, or I was writing it down on my iPhone, taking notes, was the sound of the ocean.
Yeah. I was talking about that. I mean, really, that's ahead of its time, you know? I mean, just little nuances like that.
The environmental sound effects around you, not just the enemies, but also literally the nature.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, this was a time when most games sort of had the blip, blop, beep kinds of sound effects.
It was just music. It was just music and attacks. That was it.
Exactly. And so they were thinking about atmosphere. And like you said, immersion. I mean, that's a great word for it. And like the bosses in the next room, you know, like you could tell that you were about to encounter something big.
And that's scary, man. That's a scary noise as a kid growing up. I was scared, you know, very scared when I was like 4 years old, hearing that like monster's noise, like making that, although they all made the same noise, which was kind of weird. But even though, even with that being the case, that's still kind of like for 8-bit, that's a pretty terrifying sound to hear. And it makes you a little bit more cautious going into the next room.
The wall masters are what got me.
Oh, man, that's a great point. Yeah, those are incredibly scary.
I was terrified of those things. They get you, take you all the way back to the beginning of the level. Oh, my goodness.
I even had dreams about those, like getting grabbed and like as a kid, like getting like almost being in The Legend of Zelda and getting grabbed by those things and freaking out. Like literally, I remember waking up in sweats, having nightmares about those things. Like those are the things of nightmares.
And you weren't having those same kinds of nightmares probably about like Bowser or somebody, you know?
Oh, hell no. Like, I think it was a huge leap in what was being done, and it was showing everybody else what you can still do on this console. And even, like I mentioned before, that same year, 87, you had games from Nintendo like Metroid coming out, which again, kind of dealt with atmosphere a little bit, even though it was super basic. But it kind of did at least the job of telling a story without using many words. But that's a great point.
and fear, well, I'm going to hold this point back actually until a little bit later in the discussion, but you know, the idea of a game that's not intended to be a horror game, like actually inducing fear, is something that I think is cool and had to have influenced some of the people who made a few games that I'm going to talk about later.
Well, they're frightening looking. You look at some of the enemies, whether it be like the little, I forget what the word for it, but the, you know, the horses that would fire swords basically out of their chests at you.
Yeah.
Like that
unsettling.
That, I mean, it was things like that. And also, overall, again, it was kind of like a tone that they set going into it. When you go into the underworld, it was like all bets are off. Like things are, it almost made you want to get outside of the dungeon and get back into the sunlight and then kind of relax for a little bit, then maybe take another stab at the dungeon. But again, this is kind of like years ago, but even today, like the fear, the potential ramifications of those wall hands coming after you, and then, man, I just lost all my progress. Now today it's like just a fear of, I just lost 10 minutes of play. Mm-hmm. I got to go all the way back to the dungeon again.
That's right. Yeah, this was my lunch break.
Yeah. But Josh, you made a great point in the outline. I don't know if you want to bring that up now.
So the idea about parallels to modern games.
Yeah.
So what I was going to say is, you know, you guys are talking about the Wall Masters, and I just had this thought, you know, like what games are there today that were not really intended to be horrifying or scary in some ways, but still we were so immersed that that's sort of a result of it, you know? So you might feel pride, you might feel excitement, you might feel fear. And I started thinking about the big daddies in BioShock, you know, as sort of like that's one of the few, and there's certainly things in Dark Souls and Demon Souls that, you know, that induce that same level of fear because of how powerful they are. You know, that was something that they really understood, in designing this game, that was very much ahead of its time. And, you know, even just through things like sound effects, like realizing that you're about to encounter something so big, you know, and that makes me think about BioShock and hearing the Big Daddy, you know, like maybe on the other side of the room. And so you have time to prepare for it or decide if you want to go into that room yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Just, you know, you talk about like hearing the bosses and making sure you're prepared. Well, when you fight a Big Daddy in BioShock, that's like a mini boss fight. So yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I can see the parallels there. You know, you hear a boss, you know, you're near a boss. So you want to go make sure, do you have the potion that restores all your health? Are you full in hearts? Yeah. Same kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. You might have to come back, you know, as opposed to something like Mega Man, which was, you know, a cohort, we could say, of Legend of Zelda and games of that time. You know, like you jump into the room and then the boss fight starts. You know, it's not really like built up in an atmospheric way, although that is a cool moment.
Yeah.
Still, it's very much like separate. Like you feel like you're playing a video game again all of a sudden when mm-hmm. you jump and then it loads everything in.
That's true. That's a good point.
It took 24 years, but today, 30 minutes before we started recording, I defeated Ganon and beat The Legend of Zelda.
Congrats, man. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it was incredibly easy to beat him. it was one life. It was one attempt. And I've never seen the boss battle before. So, again, if you go with spoiler alert, the Ganon's the final boss, and more or less he is kind of invisible, but you're kind of just stabbing around looking for where he is shooting his fireballs from. And the only thing I knew from previous history is that I needed the silver arrow to defeat him. So first off, I just started shooting the silver arrows all over the place to start. And after I didn't hit him and I used a potion to rejuvenate my health, I then just started using my sword. And then I started hearing the sound effects again, you know, gave you some feedback to know that you're making solid hits. You're damaging Ganon. And then as soon as you was red, I was like, that's got to be my time. Pulled out that bow and arrow, one shot. Or no, it was a couple shots of the bow and arrow. And that was it. Not really a very long ending. Just basically you pick up Zelda and It says, thank you, Hyrule. Yeah, you're the hero. I even I took a picture of it. It's you are, thanks, Link. You're the hero of Hyrule. Finally, peace returns to Hyrule. This ends the story. Mm-hmm. It lists the staff of about five people, and they didn't really they didn't use their names, their real names.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it?
And yeah, and then they then it finishes with a second quest awaits you, and you hit start. You go back to the mission or the save select screen, and you see you have three heart containers.
Link, holding the sword.
Yep, exactly. You're holding the sword, and you press start. Go for it.
And so rather than setting up a sequel at the end, like, you know, most games would today, which makes sense for business reasons, I'm not knocking that, they were concerned with giving you more value, you know, like another gameplay experience.
Well, I think Trey mentioned, you said there was actually extra space on the cart, so they just created a second quest. That's so cool.
They didn't use all the memory, and they wanted, I'm assuming, they wanted everybody to get their value with the game, their money's worth. So.
Remember those days?
Oh, yeah, they were the
every game must be 40 hours long.
Yeah. The Metacritic scores didn't matter or anything like that. It was just, we're making a game because we want to make a game that's going to be fun.
And it doesn't matter if there's a genre established for it yet, you know? Like, we'll create a genre.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Zelda, I mean, there wasn't anything like that at the time. I mean, that was brand new, and they took a risk, and boy, did it pay off.
The final thing I wanted to hit on is, again, we have 26 years of Zelda in the books, and most recently we've had Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword, and you know, before that we had Twilight Princess, and both of those preceding two kind of vastly different games in the Ocarina of Time, which for some people is the best of the best. It is more or less what the blueprint is for the 3D games, although some people say Link to the Past is the blueprint for the 3D games, but just in 3D. Do you guys think there's life in this franchise still? Because we've been hearing some rumors that come E3 in 2 days that everyone's saying, oh, hopefully Retro is, or maybe they're giving this series off to someone else, which we kind of know they're not doing. Because the producer recently came out saying he wants to work on something else other than Zelda. So it sounds like he's still working on Zelda, at least in some capacity. But do you think we're going to be going into E3 on Tuesday and seeing something different? Or do you think this kind of structure of, you know, a couple dungeons, you know, maybe there's some progression in the swords, possibly time travel, and then we beat Ganon or someone that looks like him?
Skyward Sword is a mixed bag with me. Like, I thought, like,
awesome soundtrack.
Oh yeah, fantastic!
Love that theme for that game.
I like the graphic style on it too. Like, I mean, I didn't mind it. I thought it pushed the Wii as far as the Wii could go.
Yeah.
So I did not like the world felt more compact. Like there was a lot of backtracking, like to the same zones, like they kind of change.
Yeah, searching for stuff like in the same zones you've already been to before. Like, I forget, what did you have to look for in, like, you had to find like pieces of something.
Yeah, I can't even remember. I played the game.
Man, that sucks. Yeah, we can't even
remember what that is. Isn't a good sign.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I played the game when it launched. I've only played Skyward Sword one time, and you know, I liked it, but there was a lot of things that kind of made me, you know, just kind of question it. Here's something I want to ask you guys. A lot of people have been calling for Link to have a voice. Do you guys think that's a good idea?
No, because half the people, or probably 90% of the people, are going to be pissed off. And if it's, unfortunately, if it's being developed in Japan, I mean, you have to think about what their characters tend to sound like.
That's a good point. Yeah, that it might be, you know, more of like an anime kind of game in that case, you know?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, for folks that like that, it's going to be great, but he's always been a silent protagonist, and the only kind of parallel I can look at is Bioshock, where you went from Bioshock 1 to Booker DeWitt, and where he talked, and it was to great success, but it's a completely different character. You're looking at this hero that kind of just happens to be reborn every couple generations when he's needed. Although that's, in a sense, kind of ridiculous.
It's almost like the role is more important than the character himself.
Yeah.
I think there's a connection. I think there's more of a connection to Link. Like, yeah, sure, Link is the hero. We know who Link is. But I think because he's silent, he's playing the role of the player. So the player and Link have more of a connection. Whereas you talk about Bioshock Infinite, I was looking at Booker DeWitt as a character like that was, you know, I was playing as him, sure, but he had his own thoughts and he had his own thing. Like, keeping Link silent is kind of making the connection between the player and Link more, like, intertwined. Because, you know, he doesn't have a voice, he doesn't have an opinion. So basically, he's just representing you. So...
yeah, that's true. Like, whatever, it's kind of like what I was talking about earlier, you know, like whatever stage of life you're in, the game can fit. And so sort of like Link can be whatever character you need him to be because he's silent.
Exactly. He fills that role. And like, I don't know, you know, just hearing Link talk would kind of throw me for a loop. You know, there's that animated show and good God, if you've never watched it, don't watch it. It's
Well, excuse me, Trey, but I'm trying to say here is that it is its own series. You wouldn't, I mean, you kind of look at how they transitioned Super Mario Brothers, and he basically says, you know, he has about 10 words that he can say. If they did something like that with Link, where and basically they already do it with him now, like he basically like screams when he like swings his sword really hard or something like that, or if there's like a surprise, he'll go or something like that. And I think
emotions,
he has exactly, I think that's all that's needed. And I just am sometimes worried with how it would come across, because you look at something like playing through Luigi's Mansion, where Luigi sounds super dumb. Although it's part of the charm of Luigi, for better or worse, the Legend of Zelda series is a far more serious franchise, and the tone should reflect that. So I would want something that, and for better or worse, the Zelda series never sells great. It sells to the same people that buy Zelda all the time. Yeah. They more or less are going to have to cater to those people, because otherwise they're going to lose those 2 million, 3 million sales that they actually get when a new Zelda comes out. And I think Skyward Sword did not sell very well.
You know, and I think that's partly, part of it might have to do with controls for some people, and also just that it was so late in the Wii's life after a lot of people had possibly either traded it in or lost interest in it.
Sure, good point.
That, you know, that game needed to come out probably at least a year sooner than it did.
I have hope. I'm hopeful. I think they can totally still pull it off. I just, as in, they've heard enough from people that they have to go in a different direction. Like, there has to be some kind of different structure, because we've had Link to the Past, we've had Ocarina of Time, we've had Twilight Princess, Skyward Sword, that have basically done the same formula, and now we have Link to the Past 2, which, for all intents and purposes, takes place in the same overworld as, and I think they're going to do the same thing with the Dark World for Link to the Past 2. I'm guessing the structure is going to be pretty similar too. You're going to be going into dungeons, getting items. Yeah. And I think with the Wii U, they have the opportunity, thanks to the power behind it, to do something that is far, far superior and much more... much bigger. I think the main issue that they run into is, we've seen it with the Wii U this so far, is that they don't have the staffing for it. So they would need someone like Retro to help out, or this game's never going to come out, because we've already had delays for all the launch titles like Pikmin and games like that have been delayed because they haven't had the staffing to do HD gaming.
Yeah, it's... I don't know.
I'm hopeful, though. I mean, I'm a Nintendo optimist. Like, I want them to... They have the opportunity to do some good stuff. Like I said, the 3DS, they do a shitty job with that thing, but I still have a lot of games that I need to play on it. And same thing with the Wii U. Like, they have the opportunity. They have even the structuring to do it, but it just seems like for some reason they don't take the leap, or they don't take that step that they need to really catch up to where gamers want to be right now.
Yeah.
Well, and you're making a lot of interesting points about, you know, that they're selling to the same people every time, most likely with Zelda at this point. So they really do need to be aware of what these people want. You know, like I'm always afraid of game companies making games that they think people want. But this might be a case in which that honestly, you know, I wonder if Anuma has played. And Anuma, for those who don't know, is you know, sort of considered the Zelda
person. He's the head guy. Yeah, he's the producer now.
That I wonder if he's played Dark Souls and Demon's Souls, because those tend to be the games that are mentioned most frequently by people who want Zelda to change. You know, I wonder if he's like really familiar with those games.
I can see taking some elements from Dark Souls and Demon's Souls, but good gosh, I don't know if I can handle
Zelda. But will Nintendo do that? Do they want to be known as a company that is borrowing from other people now?
I hope not. You know, because I've always liked them as innovators.
Yeah, definitely.
And they have, for the most part, they just took a really bad sidestep with Skyward Sword with the motion controls. They didn't work.
Yeah, there's going to be something with that gamepad that they do for Zelda. I don't know what yet. I don't know if, like, I mean, obviously you could probably manage the menu from, you know, the gamepad screen, but they're going to do something that's innovative. I mean, Nintendo's got a lot of detractors, but they were the first console I've owned. I've always rooted for them. I've questioned a lot of their decisions, but, you know, I always give them the benefit of the doubt. I'll give them a chance to wow me. I'm not going to turn my back on them. I buy their consoles loyal. I mean, I'm loyal to them. I'm loyal, more loyal to Nintendo than I am any other company.
Well, you're in a good spot, right? Because they're in panic mode, and, you know, when they are like the 3DS, they bring the big guns, and they sometimes get their heads out of their asses.
I think, you know, I don't think we're going to see, like, a trailer for the next Zelda. I think the next Zelda is farther off than other titles like Mario, the new 3D Mario, Mario Kart. What else do they have?
Smash Brothers. Yeah. Like, unfortunately, that stuff I don't care about. I want to see. I hope they have Zelda. Like, well, that would do it.
Like a remake, you know?
Taking the Wind Waker remake. That's going to be the thing they show off. It's almost done. But I think the next Zelda, we'll get an announcement and maybe concept art. But I don't think we'll see any footage. They might announce where they're going with features. I just think that one's farther off than people are kind of anticipating. I think the big guns they're going to hit you with are going to be Smash Brothers, 3D Mario, Mario Kart, Wind Waker HD remake, and then we'll get like an announcement maybe at the very end. Oh yeah, we're working on this. But honestly, 2014, late, maybe early 2015 is when I do new Zelda.
So yeah, you're probably right, especially with the staffing.
Yeah,
the talk we were just having.
Yeah. I mean, if they have another company, help them on it.
It's retro. Like, retro is doing something, so they have to have a franchise.
You don't think they're doing a Metroid game, though?
Those don't sell. Well, I think they sell worse.
Company, you know, I mean, they could have some of their staff helping, you know, like, corresponding with people in Japan working on a Zelda game while the rest of their staff works on a Metroid game.
That could be, I mean, you know, like, Smash Brothers, they have Namco working with them on that. I'm interested to see what Namco is going to be doing with Smash Brothers. But they're working on Smash Brothers. So, yeah, maybe Nintendo is kind of...
They're working with From Software. You heard it here first. Probably not, though.
That's a Back in My Play exclusive.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That would be interesting. But, my opinion, just, you know, I could be wrong. I'm not claiming I have any inside information. I just think we've heard, you know, they've got... The main reason I say that is because they've got Wind Waker HD. That seems to be their big Zelda title, that and A Link to the Past 2. And then, you know, we'll probably get an announcement, but I don't think there'll be any kind of trailer or concrete, like, details yet.
That's a great point, though. The Wind Waker HD is something that is probably going to make me get a Wii U, because I played Wind Waker, but I only made it to, like, the underwater Hyrule part. Either getting distracted with something else, or unfortunately the constant spending time in that sailboat was so boring, and to the point where I would have to like point my boat in a direction, get up and go to the bathroom or go get something to drink. Like, I thought that was a little bit too much. But now thinking back, like, I seem to be almost remembering the first couple stages incredibly well, and loving, you know, just hearing like the noises that like the that that would come up when you would defeat an enemy, like the tones and the notes that would come up were something that for some reason I'm looking back on is something I want to do again. So that is going to be probably a day one purchase for me. But again, it's so up in the air with this franchise right now. I don't know which way it's going to be going, and I'm kind of bummed about Link to the Past too.
Are you?
If I want to play Link to the Past, I have it. It's right next to my Super Nintendo, right there. And I think the graphics look kind of shitty.
It's an interesting style.
Sort of that new Super Mario Brothers kind of style.
Yeah, I hope that's not where they're going with that series. Good gosh.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear the music.
If I hear any want, oh my gosh, I'll lose it. I can't stand that stuff in those games. I say it over and over, Link to the Past is my favorite game. It's definitely my favorite Zelda game, and it's the top list of all time. But
are you still excited going into Link to the Past 2, knowing that you're going to know where everything is?
Well,
at least where everything is in the overworld?
I think there'll be enough fundamental changes.
I hope so.
It'll be different. I don't think it's going to... I'm worried about it tarnishing the legacy of A Link to the Past, because I have that game on a pretty high pedestal, and I don't want to play something that is in the same, world as that, and being like, what have they done? So I'm a little... I'm cautiously optimistic.
It could be really cool, though.
Yeah, it could be. I mean,
reuniting the cast.
Yeah, they had that little thing where he could become paper thin and walk on walls. I thought that was kind of...
Oh yeah, the hieroglyph thing looked cool.
That you never saw, in the original SNES game.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it could go one of two ways.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to Wind Waker HD because I like Wind Waker a lot, but that's a great game, but it's got a lot of, the sailing. People don't like the sailing. They're hoping that they can do something to not make it where you're in a boat the majority of the game, and then there's a part later in the game, the Triforce charts, that people aren't too fond of. But, without spoiling anything, I'll just leave it at that. But
there were a couple of dungeons that were cut out of the game originally, so that it could ship by the release date they wanted. I think it might not be a couple. It might just be one, and then ideas for another one. But there's a lot of talk of them, speculation that they might actually go back and finish those.
Does that sound like Nintendo?
No.
Hey, let's do some. Let's put in. Let's fix all the things people didn't like about this game.
That does not sound like Nintendo. Not the Nintendo I know.
It's not. It's not today's Nintendo's basically the, for lack of a better term, the Apple of, here, we're going to make it the way we want to make it. And most people buy it. At least they're hardcore of hardcore buy it. But I think that is where we're going. We're coming up on about 2 hours for the whole show. So that was a little bit longer than I was thinking we were going to go. But if you guys stick around, we're going to come back. We're going to be talking about the Xbox One and its implications on retro gamers such as ourselves and possibly yourself, and the things that you should consider before making a purchase. But since we didn't really do a major closing, I guess we did close out the show as when we recorded that. So never mind. Stick around. Here's some more great music from The Legend of Zelda. We'll be right back. Thank you. Okay, we're back. We're here for the fourth and final segment. Josh, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the recent events that have happened in the news for video games. Although it's not necessarily retro, some of the news that has come up is going to be affecting how we're going to be playing games down the road with the new announcement, or I guess the press release of the restrictions with the Xbox One. So did you get to check some of this stuff out, or some of the backlash, I guess?
I have, yeah. It's been really fascinating to follow. It's been also somewhat terrifying to follow. But as someone who grew up being able to actually rent and borrow games, this is just sad to see. I understand the state of affairs that would get us to this point. You know, I'm not completely out of touch to where I don't understand how this would happen from a business standpoint. But it's just really bad for consumers, you know?
There who haven't heard the news or have seen the press release, just a quick bullet point breakdown. More or less, Microsoft is looking to restrict the ability for you to rent games and to loan games and really not allow any kind of private sale. So you wouldn't necessarily be able to throw your game up on eBay like you get your new Call of Duty 48, put that up on eBay for, you know, trying to get back some money for it. You wouldn't be able to do that because the disc would be more or less locked to your system, but they are looking at being able to give you the ability to either give that to a friend who's been on your friends list for more than 40 days, or you can trade it to a participating retailer, which is probably going to be your GameStops or your Best Buys that are doing the trade-in services now. Also, your console is going to have to check in every 24 hours to make sure that if you do trade in that game, once it's in that new trade-in system, it is going to be unable to be played on your system. And also, the trade-ins themselves are always going to be publisher-dependent. So a publisher, yeah, exactly. So a publisher could basically say, actually, I forget who made this. I was listening to another podcast, and I think it might have been the guys on 8-4, actually, who said, you know, maybe when the new Madden comes out, they're not going to let you trade in that, you know, Madden, whatever it is. It's Madden 25 this year, but maybe you're not going to be able to trade in Madden 14 until, or Madden 15 until the new one comes out. So they could really restrict you that way to basically break the whole system, because once the new, you know, sports games come out, the previous ones are more or less useless. And then finally, the games themselves will be able to be played with all your family members. So it's just going to be on that console, but I guess you can have about 10 Xbox Live accounts on there as well for the family to be playing them. But still, what the big thing comes down to for us that likes to play old games or to keep our systems in the closet and revisit them down the road is that you will basically run the risk of not being able to play these games because that Xbox has to call home to the Microsoft servers. So if 20 years down the line, I guess Microsoft decided to take down their servers like they took down the Xbox One, or I guess the original Xbox Live servers, so you cannot play those games on Xbox Live. The same situation could be had for this 10, 15 years down the road, where all those games will be more or less like virtually useless.
Right. And I think it seems like Valve is the only company that's been really clear about their plans, right? That they would actually make sure that the end user would be able to download their games 20 years, 30 years down the line, whatever it might be.
I think it's interesting because even with Microsoft, they are prefacing everything that I just said, saying that they have the total right to completely change these rules the way they see fit if, you know, they just happen to want to, or the publishers want them to do it. And that's, again, as we are recording this, the day before E3, it's really the Wild West come tomorrow, because Sony might be doing the same thing, or, you know, down the road with Nintendo's next console, they might look into doing the same thing. But it is making me almost think, hey, you know what? That instead of that $400 going towards a new Xbox or a new PlayStation 4, maybe I'll just like go and buy some, you know, I'm moving to Japan in a couple months. Maybe I'll just go and put that money into a bunch of Super Famicom games or buy some like TurboGrafx games or something like that, because I know no matter what, especially with those solid state games, the non-disc based games, those things are basically going to run for as long as I'm going to live, as long as I take care of them and don't dump them in a, like a bowl of water.
Right. Yeah, there's something really beautiful about cartridges when you think about that, right? As long as someone has it written all over it, you pretty much know it's going to work.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, yeah, and so, I mean, you know, so that it still looks decent aesthetically, I mean, you know it's going to work, unless it's maybe like an NES cartridge or something like that. I have a couple of other thoughts that I wanted to bring up. One of them, you were talking about this the day before E3, so we're wondering about Sony's plans, and then maybe Nintendo down the line. And I think we pretty much assume that Sony's going to have some sort of DRM stuff going on. But what I wonder is, do you think that Nintendo would actually do that?
I hope not.
To the same extent that Microsoft and Sony might be doing it?
I think that with Sony's position right now, they're really banking on first-party stuff anyways, because they're not getting the support from the third parties either way. There's stories that have come out saying EA is basically just going to say, for the rest of 2013, we really don't have much, but come 2014, maybe we'll look at publishing some stuff on there. Ubisoft has still been relatively supporting of the Wii U, and obviously the other in the big three, Activision, they're not bringing the new Call of Duty out in the Wii U, which is a vote of no confidence for the most part, because if they can't even get their best-selling game to sell on the console, I don't think they are necessarily worrying about the copy protection and stuff like that. Or maybe that's the reason they're not even putting their games on there in the first place, is because they want everyone to go this way in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they've probably felt disconnected from Nintendo's approach, I guess, since the Wii, right? Like some of the other big third-party publishers have. But, you know, I kind of wonder if Nintendo has sort of unintentionally fallen into, like, the perfect position in terms of seeming pro-consumer with this whole DRM thing. Because, you know, sometimes Nintendo is criticized as being somewhat backwards-thinking, although I love the company to death. People will talk about that, is that they're not forward thinking enough. So maybe this is a case where their lack of forethought for what it might be like in the future with DRM will be something that actually gains them a lot of goodwill.
Yeah, personally, I was not really 100% interested. I'm like interested in the Wii U, but again, with price drops and things like that being rumored, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And obviously the games hopefully are going to be coming on, this week for E3, but me personally, I think that they're going to be in a better position with the hardcore gamers who are not happy, because again, we're, you know, as talking to the audience out there, a lot of our listeners are probably going to be coming from NeoGAF, and there's just for lack of a better term, a shitstorm about all this DRM stuff, and people actually saying, actually, I'm just going to go PC and Wii U because I know I can get those super high-end or those top-tier games on the PC, except for those first-party exclusives from Sony and Microsoft if they do decide to go with that DRM. And then I can get all the great Nintendo franchises, and from the rumors out there, they're going to be coming with some heavy hitters for their Nintendo Direct this week. So personally, I think they're looking a lot better, even though, yeah, they are kind of dated.
Yeah, and it seems sort of like they've fallen into this. And, you know, even a month ago, most of the press, or at least most of the NeoGAF discussions and, you know, wider gaming community discussions have been pretty negative about Nintendo. But it's interesting what you're saying. I've seen similar posts, people saying PC and Wii U. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, that would have been unheard of. Before the Xbox One reveal, when was that, like May 20th or whatever that was, that was really just such a big shift in terms of consumers banding together and trying to affect change, which, you know, also that's been something interesting to follow. I don't want to go too far into that because we'll eventually lose focus on what we started with. But the idea that gamers realize and want to actually have this discourse with big companies, with big major corporations, this is really fascinating. And, you know, to have people from these corporations actually saying, we're listening, but then doing the exact opposite anyway, right? Like, that's kind of what happened with Microsoft, as Major Nelson and a few people said, we're listening, and then still the announcement that we got this past Thursday was exceedingly negative. It was pretty much the worst case scenario for what most of the hardcore, and I use that term very reluctantly, what most of the hardcore gamers would want.
Yeah, and the wording was terrible. Like, the wording that they used was, in like you said, trying to have them say that, oh yeah, we heard you, so look at all this extra crap we're doing for you. And it turns out that, you know, they've more or less gone from, you know, shit to suck in my eyes. They still are not doing a good job at handling this stuff. So when we started recording this segment, I was hoping we could do a little time travel stuff with this because our third panelist, Trey, had not been on Skype yet, but he has jumped on. He is available. So we are going to pause for a quick second. We're going to get him on, and then we're going to get his take. Okay, we're back. I know it sounded like we weren't even gone, but the question I'm going to be tossing over to Trey is just get his opinion on this whole Xbox One DRM issue. And again, yeah, Trey, you obviously heard the news. Do you have any opinions on how this is going to like influence your purchase at all, or you know what this means for, you know, potentially gaming on it down the road?
Well, it's unfortunate, but it seems like it's... It doesn't seem like it's something Microsoft entirely came up with on their own. I kind of feel like it was a little bit of pushing from publishers as well. So I like, as far as my purchase, I don't really know for sure until I find out if Sony's doing the same thing, because they really haven't said either or. Like, you know, there was that big thing on Gaff about, you know, the hashtag PS4 no DRM and stuff like that, and they saw that, but they really haven't announced concrete what they're doing. So I'm going to kind of hold off just to see what kind of games there are and see what Sony does as far as that goes. But it's unfortunate, especially the fact that I can't loan games out to friends, because I do that right now. I have a lot of friends that borrow games, and I can't do that now. So
this is a thought that I have as well. You know, and Trey, I know you're somebody who came from the same generation of gaming. You know, word of mouth used to be really big for the gaming industry when it was still, you know, sort of cutting its teeth and coming of age a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was a way to expose your friends to great franchises, and you still do it, and so do I. You know, it's almost as if this is looked at as being something of the past.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, you know, I can't, well, I guess... You know, I'm still a little kind of fuzzy on some of the details, but apparently, like, if you have your profile, you can log on an Xbox with your profile and still have access to your games. I think that's what they confirmed. But, like, I can't, you know, hype this game up to you and say, oh, you know, like, try it out. Let me let you borrow it. I can't do that anymore. And that's, you know, I don't... It's unfortunate. I guess it's their version of what they think the gaming is going to become, but... You know, gone are the days where, you know, I could, you know, play something and tell you how awesome it is and let you borrow it and play it firsthand. If you like it, you can go buy it. It just seems like we're in a new era. It's not really one that's kind of, it's getting a lot of negativity and not a lot of positivity.
So. It's making this not so much, not as much fun anymore.
Yeah.
It makes me less, like, interested in buying, like, I don't buy a lot of digital stuff unless it's, like, really discounted through Steam or on PSN or Xbox Live, or thankfully, you know, finally Nintendo is doing some kind of discounts, whether it's with the like the 30-cent games on the Wii U, and they're also doing some kind of bundle discounts on the 3DS eShop. But really, I don't like investing my money into stuff that I don't know if it's going to be able to be played either 5 or 10 years down the road. Like, same thing with, like, I bought a bunch of UMDs because I think that's a much better option than buying a lot of PSP games through downloading, again, unless you get it like for free through PlayStation Plus. And it's going to be huge for my buying purchases, because I'm literally not going to buy games unless they get down to $10 or $20. And the speculation is that maybe they'll do some kind of like Steam discount stuff, but it does not sound like something that Microsoft really wants to do. Games are getting more and more expensive.
Yeah, I mean, look at their, they got the games on demand thing now. You can go browse the games. Black Ops 1 still like $50 on there.
All their games, their discounts have always been terrible, and they are blocked by, you have to have a gold subscription to even to get the discounts on most of the stuff.
A paywall, it's just, it's frustrating. It's really frustrating because this next generation, it should be about the consumers, and it doesn't seem like it's, they're trying to keep publishers happy, and then, with whatever they have left over, well, this is what we have for the consumers. But
has this influenced your opinion on, again, it seems like this is coming from those top tier publishers like the Activisions, the EAs, and the Ubisofts. Is this influencing your kind of like future, buying potential with those companies? Does it make you less likely to buy their games because you're like, I just don't want to support these monoliths like that if they're going to treat me like a terrible consumer when I just want to buy games?
Yeah, in some aspects, I won't run out and buy every single game they put out now, especially, like EA's kind of gone downhill. Like, I don't think a lot of their games that have come out this year have been big hits. Like, Crysis 3 kind of flopped a little bit. Dead Space 3, a lot of people didn't like it compared to the other two. It seems like, gone are the days when I can pay, $50 or $60 and get a complete game on that disc. Like, now they want you to get all this DLC content, and I don't know, they're pulling the strings, and it does kind of make me have a little bit of animosity towards them. But,
and kind of what you guys are talking about right now in terms of purchasing decisions, it sounds like fewer and fewer games might be purchased because of this. Like, everything becomes like a big decision in terms of purchasing, instead of being able to impulse buy something and know that you could give it to a friend or trade it in or do something like that later on.
Well, there's no security. Like, I like to, again, like I was saying, I like buying games. It's fun to buy games, even if that's why, like, a bunch of us have backlogs that games that we barely even have played, but it's fun to buy the games. You see it on sale or something like that, you just want to own it. And if I don't have that security that, all right, maybe I'm not going to play it this year, can I play it 5 years down the road? What if I don't like it? I can't even get rid of the game if I don't like it. Like, it just completely removes all kind of flexibility that, as someone that also buys Blu-rays or maybe you still buy CDs, that's completely eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Flexibility is a good word for it. Sorry, Trey.
No, you're fine. I've got a buddy that's very upset about the Microsoft stuff. I mean, he's like he's contemplating just building a PC and being strictly a PC gamer at this point. But he's worried that movies might go this route sooner or later, and we might have the same situation with movies where you like basically have them locked to some kind of account. But that's a bigger industry, so I don't really know, what they could do there, but.
I think that bringing up movies is really interesting, and it might have some parallels. I think that, when you look at what Microsoft has been doing, I wonder how much they've looked at consumers' habits with stuff like Netflix, and that people are content to just watch whatever's available. And I know that's different because you're just paying for a monthly service and whatever's available is what you watch. But right. I think it might be similar in terms of, they don't make any guarantees that you'll be able to watch, like, let's say you put Arrested Development in your queue and you plan on watching it way down the line because you have this huge backlog of TV shows you're watching, which a lot of people do that these days. And, they don't really make any guarantees that anything will be available like a year from now or 2 years from now or whatever it might be. And people seem okay with that, so I wonder if Microsoft has been influenced at all at looking at services like that.
Oh, you're giving them way too big of a benefit of the doubt. Like, I have nothing that they've done in the last 5 years. And this is like, I have a weird track record with the current gen stuff. Like, I was hardcore Xbox 360. I saw you know, Gears of War on that thing. I saw Halo 3 and I said I needed to get that thing. I ended up like making a transition into the PlayStation 3 because, again, the games just weren't on it that I wanted to play anymore. It seemed to be popping up more on the PlayStation 3. And just because, again, a lot of these practices turned me off. Like, I didn't want to pay for gold anymore. I don't really play games on Xbox Live. I have one really great friend that I play games with online, and he's got a PS3 too. So I think, again, you got to kind of look at their track record and how they have kind of morphed into what they are going into E3 next week. And yeah, you can just see they're becoming more and more anti-consumer. They're just starting to, like, again, you look at the Project $10 stuff, all those things that were just really making you're someone who goes in, pays $60. I don't care if you pay $60 to get it on sale for $40. You bought that game. They're making your life harder after you paid for the game, where if you wanted to just spend a couple, like an extra $100, get your system modded, you can just go and play all those games for free. They're just making it harder on the people that are just honest people that want to play video games and not deal with all those extra hurdles that are on the PC or that deal with modding a console to make your life easier.
Yeah, I think Microsoft, you know, like they're giving you a lot of options, but like, okay, for instance, like I bought an Xbox 360 at launch and I was a big fan, like, you know, when they threw Gears of War at us and everything like that. It seemed like up until 2009 they kind of had their focus on games, paying money for exclusive titles, pumping out lots of content. They were like on the ball. Then when they announced the Kinect, they wanted to start targeting the audience that the Wii kind of captured. So they wanted to try to, you know, take their stab at it. It seemed like they kind of lost their focus on like the hardcore gamers and the people that, you know, bought the system just to play games. I guess they kind of had the attitude, well, they've got Call of Duty and they've got Halo, so let's focus on, you know, bringing in some new customers to the system. So I felt like they kind of just abandoned, you know, this type of stuff I liked. And then, you know, about the same time, Sony introduces PlayStation Plus. They're giving free games out, like, a bunch. They want everybody to play these games. So, you know, the Sony and Microsoft kind of did, like, a switch, almost. And, you know, I traded in my Xbox 360 and all my games. And that, you know, I got a bunch of trading credit. That's what I'm going to use for the next-gen system. But, you know, I just lost the desire to have the system.
So, Josh, just kind of wrapping up final thoughts. We're coming up on, like, the 20-minute mark. So, I mean, it's hard to even have this discussion without seeing what comes tomorrow.
Right.
But, you know, I just kind of like final thoughts on the whole thing, and, you know, just going into the next gen entirely, is this something that is just kind of influenced your potential buying purchases? Because let's just say, for the fun of it, Sony's doing the same thing. They're doing basically the same exact thing that Microsoft is. Are you going to be getting an Xbox or a PS4, you know, come this holiday season?
I'm not sure, and I never thought I would be someone who would say that, but just as time has gone on and I've read more and more about, you know, sort of the loss of, I mean, it's hard to say consumer rights, because I understand that it's not necessarily, some of these things aren't really rights to trade something in necessarily, but it's just not really what I want out of gaming, and I see gaming as a very social thing. And I like the idea of being able to easily bring a game over to someone's place and leave it over there even if I want to. So that tends to scare me quite a bit. And, you know, it almost makes me think about the transition that the music industry faced in the late 90s with people downloading a lot. You know, because this is largely in response to pirates, to console pirating. And so it kind of seems a little bit like that. And the record companies really had a hard time with that transition and botched it in a lot of ways and lost a great deal of goodwill from the audience. And I'm thinking that Microsoft and potentially Sony might soon find themselves in a similar state, you know, and somebody like, okay, Amazon MP3 came about and I started buying all of my digital albums through them because they were all completely DRM free. And that eventually prompted iTunes to make a big change. And so, you know, they were sort of the up-and-comer. And so I wonder if maybe Nintendo would be like Amazon MP3 in this case, or if Steam does the, or if Valve does the Steam Box or something like that. You know, maybe they'll really
push the idea of letting things be more free to the consumers, and that will kind of force Microsoft and Sony's hands.
Okay, how about you with final thoughts?
If Sony comes out with something like similar to Microsoft, it's really going to be about what system has what games. If Microsoft's able to come out and announce like exclusive, like say, you know, this is just throwing this out there. Say they got like Fallout 4 as an exclusive title, then I'm going to get an Xbox more than likely. But, you know, it's really about, you know, I'm a gamer. It's about the games. So, well,
let me ask you this: day one, though, like let's say that Fallout's there day one, are you going to pay?
It's going to be delayed. It's going to be delayed. It's Bethesda, right?
Yeah, of course. I don't 2016. You know,
yeah, it's June 9th. If it comes out in November, I don't think there's any way. Like,
but in a hypothetical world, let's say it's there day one, even though we know it won't be. Something that, whatever the game is for someone that they really care about. So for you, mm-hmm. let's say it's Fallout 4. Mm-hmm. Do you buy it day one, even with this, even with the DRM concerns when we haven't seen how it's going to play out?
Yes, I think I would buy it day one. I'd be a little... cautious. I mean, you know, you know, most of my friends are on Xbox. Like I have, you know, I have PlayStation 3 now and it's kind of, you know, like abandoned. Like I don't really see many of my friends on there. So I think a lot of them are going to get an Xbox just because. So like, you know, I would have that option, but you know, I'm a little cautious, but if they announce some blockbuster titles, then I would be a little bit more inclined to go with them just because, you know, like I said, first and foremost, I'm a gamer. So I'm going to get the system that's got the games that appeal to me the most. You know, there'll be some negatives, but you know,
man, I don't even know you. I come on, man. I thought we were all going to be united on this, but
it's real hard to say anything now.
Sure. It's exactly tomorrow. They could announce, they could come in tomorrow and they could announce the greatest game that I've ever seen in my life. And again, I might just have to say, all right, I'm guess I'm paying $460 to rent this game for a couple of years, and I got to make sure that I always have internet, which I will, but it's, again, you know, it's why I've put a lot more of my money recently into the 3DS and to, like we were talking before, like buying things like PlayStation Plus, where I already go into it knowing what to expect. I know I'm renting games for $60 a year or $50 a year, and you know, I've been ecstatic with what has come with that $50 a year.
Yeah, you're getting, I mean, like you're getting really good games.
They're next week we get Uncharted 3, we get XCOM, which was, and again, like all this stuff, if you have a PC, that seems to be the best way to go, because games on PC, they're going to be like $10 a month or two after launch on Amazon or on Steam, and you can download those, and I can look at a $10, like I basically look at Steam and things that I buy on Amazon, I'm more or less renting stuff, and I never pay more than $15 for a PC game, and I have every major PC release. Like, and I'm not missing out.
Right?
I mean, yeah, I can wait.
Paying that sort of price, that low of a price.
Yeah, but then again, we're going to be paying $60-$70.
Exactly, that's the difference. That's the scary difference.
Okay.
I'd say my closing thoughts is Microsoft's catching a lot of flack for this. I want to see Nintendo go into 3DS mode with the Wii U and throw everything at us. Because they did that with the 3DS. The 3DS was kind of, like, I mean, it had a lot of hype, but then when they started throwing all the games, oh man, that thing's on fire. I'd like to see them do that with the Wii U, and they've got this is their time to step up. And
I love that thought. I think I think Nintendo is the underachieving super incredible athlete. Like they are, you know, you look at these you know, athletes that like are this athlete that is incredible wide receiver, but he's always going to jail. He's always doing drugs and stuff like that. That's how I look at Nintendo, because The 3DS is it does have games now, but you look at things like the Virtual Console is terrible. It is it is disgraceful what that is on the 3DS, the availability of games, and also on the Wii U. I've started like two threads just crapping on this stuff, because I love the 3DS and I love my Vita, but the Vita has like a couple hundred or over 100 PS1 games that are like classics. Right now, there's about a dozen NES games, about a dozen Game Boy, original Game Boy games, a couple Game Gear games, and that is it for Virtual Console on the 3DS. And Wii U seems to be picking up a little bit, but the Nintendo, again, they I always feel like they could be doing better, but we just kind of have to deal with it and live with what they're going to give us, and most of us are just going to... gonna, you know, swallow it anyways and buy their damn games because they make good games.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
So is Nintendo Plaxico Burress?
What's that?
Is Nintendo Plaxico Burress?
Oh, more or less, yeah.
shot themselves in the leg.
Yeah, they just narrowly miss their testicles every time they shoot themselves.
Very, very talented, though, when he wants to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's available. All right, well... the final part of segment four, we're going to be hitting on a game that we think may not be super popular, a retro game that people should maybe check out. Maybe they should go on either its Virtual Console or hit up eBay, their local flea market, and pick this game up. So do you guys have a game in mind that you're ready to talk about? Oh, no.
All right. I defer to you.
All right, you know what? I'm going to start off because this is going to be the topic of next week's episode, so I'm going to hit on it right now, and that's a Sunsoft game for the Nintendo Entertainment System called Journey to Silius, and I had never heard of this. I had never heard of this game until about 3 years ago, and it is hard as hell, but it has probably in the top 10 for music on the NES. It is fantastic music. It's super catchy. It's what you're going to hear as the outro for this week's episode. And to give you a quick breakdown, it's really your side-scrolling shooting game. Really nothing too special about it, although you do have a couple different options of guns right at the start, whether it be a pistol or shotgun. And I believe the other one is like a rifle, a little bit more powerful. Oh, it's a machine gun. And it is... just fantastic. It's incredibly challenging, but if you start learning the patterns of the enemies, you can start getting through the first couple levels. And if you just want to get interested, go to YouTube or go to your favorite game music website, look up some of that music, and it is top tier. It is the best of the best that Sunsoft had to offer in terms of music on the lines of Blaster Master and Batman. It is something unlike all the other games that you're going to hear on the NES, because like Sunsoft had that distinct kind of sound with all their games across the platform. Mm-hmm. You're going to get that here too. So, all right.
It's the same composer for a lot of these games.
Probably. I don't know. I'm going to do that research for next week's episode though.
Yeah, that person really slays.
So, do you guys have a game, any game, something that is not at the top or the front of someone's mind?
I busted out my N64 the other day.
There we go.
Is that retro enough?
Hell yeah, it is. That's like, okay, dude, that's right. That's 96. That's almost 20 years old.
Yeah, God, oh, man. I busted that out, and I was in the mood to play a Rare game, but I played a Rare game that didn't get a lot of... Well, I don't know. Like, I saw a topic about it on Gap not too long ago, but Blast Corp, anybody play that?
Yeah, that was the game I was going to mention. That's insane that you mentioned. Oh, wow.
Maybe we should do that instead.
We can double up and talk about that one. No, I mean, I beat it. I was like probably in like middle school when I played that, I think. But I beat that game then, and I went back and just kind of played some of the levels. It's interesting game. It's something I haven't, like, unlike I haven't ever played before. It's just you can control these like robots and you go on like these demolition missions. I really don't even remember the plot. I just kind of busted it out and started playing.
Well, it's really more, it's more of like an arcadey style of gameplay.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. I mean, like,
it's kind of secondary.
I was going through the missions and I found one like where you're on the moon and I was like messing around with that, but I don't remember too much about it. Now I kind of want to go and play it now that I've talked about it a little bit,
It's actually pretty hard. It's a really dense gameplay. It's just like so much packed into each level.
Yeah, and there's like this one, I cannot remember the name of the vehicle, but you have to like do these turns into these buildings and destroy the buildings. I can't remember what the name of the vehicle is. I think the Sideswiper or something like that. Oh, I can't remember now. It's going to drive me crazy. I wasn't prepared for the the recommendation. So
it's a new segment on the podcast.
Yeah, that would be one I'm gonna have to go back and play it myself too. Oh. But
and Blast Corps is not so hard to find anymore. Yeah. It's not on the virtual console, I don't think. But
I think because Microsoft owns them now, there's some kind of discrepancy about releasing that. So
exactly, but it sold well enough that at most retro shops, I've noticed. I was just at one yesterday, and they have, you know, it tends to be like 3 or 4 copies, and they're less than $20.
Yeah,
and
that would be one.
Yeah, it's an interesting game. I rented it back in the day, but I never really it never clicked with me for some reason. But if you're out there, you have an N64, pick up Blast Corps and Journey to Silius. Those are this week's recommendations.
Oh, I have one more really small game I want to
mention.
It's called Link to the Past.
I heard of that one. What's that one about? It's not Zelda 2. I could have sworn someone's going to pick Zelda 2 because that game, I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever play that game like more than 30 minutes without wanting to throw the controller. But
I think it's a lot like Link 2 or Zelda 2. Actually, it's all side scrolling from what I've heard. I don't know. I'll have to play Link to the Past sometime.
Yeah, they got a sequel coming out for that, so that would be a great time to pick it back up. And I'm sure they'll put it up for $8 on your 3DS and your Wii U.
I'll make a bold statement about that. Greatest of all time.
Yes.
The greatest game of all time?
Oh, that's my number one. It's been my number one game since I was 7 years old. Has not changed.
I can see that. I can definitely see it as being the greatest Zelda game of all time, at the very least.
Yeah. But me personally, my favorite game of all time.
Okay, we're going to have to come back to that because it is, again, that's one of those... Man, maybe we should just do back-to-back Zelda episodes.
It is tempting.
If you talk about Link to the Past, I got to be there.
All right, because I know there's people in the thread who are more or less like, yeah, you know, make sure. And for people who are listening, because I'm gonna send this out to other places as well. When we say thread, we're usually talking about NeoGaf.com.
Yeah.
But people wanted to do off the beaten path kind of game, so that's why I was thinking Journey to Silius, because that's something not a lot of people have checked out. And, you know, so many other people have talked ad nauseum about Link to the Past. But, again...
And to be very clear, that was a joke.
Oh, okay.
I don't think that was completely clear. I was trying to...
No, see, we're this being our first episode, to pick up on cues and sarcasm will take time.
It is tricky. I almost said Super Mario Bros. 3 as my really unique game that's off the beaten path. But, yeah.
Yeah, that's another good one. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this week's show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Like I said, you can stick around for some Journey to Silius music. It is incredibly good. And, you know, for Josh and Trey, thank you so much for listening and downloading. And if you can, subscribe through iTunes and also share this with your friends. If you have friends that are kind of, you know, like into games, or they used to play games with you back in the day, we'd love for you to share that with them as well. So again, thanks for listening. Check out the website back in what's the website? What's this called?
Back in my play.
Backinmyplay.com. Welcome to awesome. The podcast.
Yeah, it is. I like that.
Very biased, but I like it.
Thank you for the domain name, Hubber.com. Take care.